National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History, Number 2. My name is Bernice Herzog, and my respondent's name is Dr. Sidney Busis. This is Wednesday, May the 5th, 1993. Sidney, you did tell us how old you are, but you didn't tell us when your birthday is.
My birthday?
Yeah.
September 2nd, 1921. I was born on Labor Day.
We have spoken many times about your father. I know his last name, but I don't know his first
David.
Name.
And my grandson who lives in Pittsburgh is David, so it's a David Busis today.
That's nice.
And my father died the day before his 71st birthday.
When and why did you choose otology?
Well, I really chose otolaryngology, disease of the ears, nose, and throat, I think primarily because of my uncle, Dr. Louis Friedman, who was in the specialty, and he was idolized in our family. And I grew up in a pharmacy. My father was a druggist, and I grew up in the drugstore. And my father always had the highest respect for physicians, and I had that same respect for them. And so I decided to go into medicine, and then when I finished my medical school, and my internship, I decided to go into the specialty that my uncle was in. So that's how I got into otolaryngology. And then otology is a subspecialty of the ear, and I just found that the ear is fascinating. I think hearing is one of the most important senses, and there's great satisfaction in restoring hearing and clearing up draining ears and so forth, so I just like it.
Good. What professional societies in this field do you belong to? And do you hold any office?
Before I go on, I just want to mention one other thing. We talk about the difference between blindness and deafness. And Helen Keller, the great teacher who was both blind and deaf, said that blindness separates people from things, and deafness separates people from people, because we really communicate in human life by speech, by language, and so that's why it's so important. I belong to a number of medical societies, starting with the local county society, the state society, AMA. I belong to a lot of national societies in my field, like the American Neurotology Society, which is a society of doctors who specialize in the diseases of hearing and balance. And that I was an officer. I was secretary-treasurer of that, and I was president of that organization. I'm also a fellow of the American College of Surgeons. I belong to the Barony Society. Barony was a brilliant physician who won the Nobel Prize in 1921 for determining and finding out how the inner ear works. He was an Austrian Jew who wasn't very welcome in Austria, and he was taken up by the Swedes, and he went to Uppsala, Sweden, where he set up his practice and did all his research. And to this day, the Swedes consider him Swedish. He was really an Austrian Jew.
In your teaching of didactic courses at Pitt Med School, did you use any of your own textbooks?
I never wrote a textbook. I've written numerous chapters for textbooks. I've never written a whole textbook myself. I did write a monograph on neurotology back in 1965, which is one of the first ones written, and was widely well-received throughout the world, actually. I got reprint requests from all over the world, mostly actually from Japan, second to the United States. So I've used slides from that material, information from it, but I haven't published in my own textbook.
Have you done much research in your field?
Only clinical research. I've never been a basic researcher because I've been in clinical practice. So I've done some things like that, keeping records of certain diseases and so forth, maybe certain medications, but I've never done any basic research.
What progress, besides the size, have you noticed in hearing aids?
Well, I think the circuits are better. There are hearing aids now that can be tailored to match the hearing loss of the individual. And some of them are now using computer chips, so they're like hybrids. They're part analog and part digital computer. And so that we can provide people with what I might call premium hearing aid, might cost two or three times what the ordinary hearing aid costs, but it can be programmed so that even the patient themselves can program that a noisy place push one button, a quiet place push another button. So programmable hearing aids and special circuits, I would say, are the future of hearing aids, and I think they're going to get better, too.
Good.
So you have to remember one thing, that hearing aids cannot restore perfectly normal hearing. Not like a pair of glasses can restore vision, because with glasses that have refractive error, like the light isn't bent right, you put glass on, bend the light right, and you hear normally, or you see normally, rather. But in most cases, people who need a hearing aid have what we call a nerve type of deafness, sort of analogous to having retinal disease in the eye. You know, the glasses sometimes can't help that, and so we can't really make the nerve work perfectly.
Well, other than the prosthetic, has there been any progress in theory, either medically or surgically in otology?
Well, the antibiotics, of course, have revolutionized otology. When I was in medical school, the Eye and Ear Hospital did mastoidectomies maybe several a week. Now they're rare. I'm talking acute mastoid in children. So there have been a lot of antibiotic advances. There have been other advances, too, in therapy.
Many medical as well as auxiliary medical practitioners are finding that the bloom is off the rose, so to speak, inasmuch as patients are encouraged to doubt the veracity and the ability of their doctors and express these doubts before or during treatment. What is your reaction to this turn of events?
Well, I'm saddened by it because I said earlier, in days past, I think there was respect for physicians. I think physicians respected patients. There was mutual understanding. The so-called physician-patient relationship was good. Today, unfortunately, it's an adversarial relationship because of one litigation. We live in a very litigious society. This affects not only physicians, but products. There's a lot of product liability litigation. And even lawyers are suing lawyers. Seemingly everybody is prepared to sue. And that's a very unfortunate situation.
Does the implied threat of malpractice litigation, as encouraged by lawyers, color your judgment and force you to perform procedures that you ordinarily wouldn't do?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I don't think it changes my techniques and my procedures. It makes you more cautious, obviously, and if there's a question sometimes, for example, whether you get an x-ray or not, you might get the x-ray, whereas other times you might wait, because if something went wrong and you were sued, someone could say, well, doctor, why didn't you get an x-ray? So that's called defensive medicine, and I have to admit that everybody has to do that to a certain extent. But that really doesn't pervade my practice.
Well, does it also mean that the practice of medicine is more difficult now than what it used to be?
More difficult in the sense that you don't have the same feelings you did before. Everybody was on the same team, you know. Here you feel that maybe someone's going to be an adversary. So in that respect, it's more difficult. Technologically, in some respects, it's easier because we have techniques today we didn't have before. For example, the CT scan, the MRI scan, it's so popular these days, it's really miraculous. You can, like, look inside somebody's head. I remember when I was in training, we used to do x-rays and pneumoencephalograms, put air in the head, which is very painful. It didn't show that much. And today, with scanning, MRI scanning, there's a world of difference. So technology has made it, in some respects, easier. So it's a balance.
All things being equal, would you choose medicine as a career again, considering the time, the expense, and now the legal safeguards and all the paperwork that's necessary?
It's a difficult question. You have to put yourself back in age, you know, 30, 40 years, so it's difficult to say, but I think that I would, yes.
You have been a member of many religious and secular organizations, a president or an officer in some, and how have these duties affected you personally in your relationship with people?
I think it's been very rewarding. I think that when you get involved in a community, which is the way I like to look at it, whether it be local, national, or international, you meet wonderful people, and you make fast friends that you would not even know about, know they exist if you weren't involved in the community. So that I think in that respect, it's very gratifying. And also, you have a certain purpose in all this. You feel like you want to do something. Most of these are Jewish organizations, actually. You want to do something with Jewish people, so you feel some gratification in that regard, too.
Sydney, in your community work, what was your happiest experience, and what were you disappointed in? What aspects were you disappointed in? Community work.
The happiest experience? Well, that's difficult to say. I don't know what you mean by the happiest experience.
What did you enjoy most? What did you think worked best?
Well, I got great satisfaction at the temple, for example. We were able to restore the temple. That was very gratifying. We started that project, and we had this huge amount of money that had to be raised, and we thought we could never do it, and somehow it happened. I thought that was very gratifying.
In what way were you disappointed in any of the programs that you participated in community work?
Well, I'm disappointed in the way things have turned out in certain agencies, for example. I was very much involved with the Jewish Family and Children's Service, and I thought it was a wonderful agency, and it saddens me to see the troubles they're having today, for example. Things of that nature trouble me. I'm troubled by the fact that we never seem to be able to raise enough money in our community to meet the needs of the community. On an international scene, I'm very troubled by the fact that Israel still doesn't have a peace with their neighbors. That's very troubling to me. I'm also troubled by the rise of anti-Semitism, both here and abroad. On the other hand, I'm sort of comforted by the fact that I think the Jewish people are strong, and I think they will survive despite all the predictors of doom. The demographic study predicts that the Jewish population will fall, and talks about intermarriage. That saddens me. So a lot of the dynamics of the Jewish people are of concern to me.
And speaking of Israel, what was your reason for going to Israel so often? And what was your reaction to the various projects that you saw?
Well, we first went to Israel in 1967, shortly after the Six-Day War. And I went on a mission, the United Jewish Federation mission, and we were planning to stop in Rome on the way home. And I must admit at the time, I'd never been to Israel before, and I was sort of, wasn't so sure about Israel, but I thought we'd have a great time in Rome. As it turns out, our trip to Israel was fascinating. It was a wonderful, wonderful trip to Israel, a marvelous guide. And when we went to Rome, it was a total letdown, just a total letdown. It was like nothing after having been in Israel. So Sylvia and I were excited about it. And of course, we've always been involved in Federation work, and the work of national agencies. And we decided in 1970 that we would take our children to Israel because we have four sons. I wanted them to see the state of Israel. So we took them in 1970 when one was a senior, 1970, one was in college, one was a senior in high school, one was in lower grades in high school, and one was in grade school, all different ages. And we had our own guide who took us all through the state. And he sensed that our boys liked the tells, that's the digs where the excavation, the archaeological excavations. And as a matter of fact, our second son, who was a senior in high school at the time, was so intrigued that he applied early decision to the University of Pennsylvania because he wanted to go into archaeology. As a matter of fact, he did, and he ended up changing careers, but he worked for several years in Israel digging and studying at Hebrew University. He spent a year there. And so it had a great impact on him. And then, so that was a wonderful trip. And then we went back later with some of our boys to a second time. And when my son lived in Israel for a week, we visited him for a year rather. We visited him, and his brothers also visited him. And then the other trips were primarily trips around the Jewish Federation, United Jewish Federation of Pittsburgh, and went to spend time at Jewish Agency, went to the agency meetings last year. So basically there have been community missions to Israel. We really have not gone just like on a vacation. We've always sort of gone with a purpose. And every time we go, we're fascinated. And of course, at this point in time, we have a lot of friends in Israel that we visit. We also were involved in the veterans program where they took disabled Israeli veterans to this country. Sylvia Robinson started that program, and we've hosted three of them in our home, and they've become like family to us, so that we have those connections. Did I answer your question? I'm not sure.
Well, just if you could give me your reaction to the various projects. I mean, the project, how the projects progressed, like desalinization, trees, different projects.
Well, I think that Israel's done a remarkable job, an unbelievable job, what they have done in every respect, in forestation through the Jewish National Fund. Israel Bond Organization has done a lot of work. Of course, we're most familiar with the Jewish Agency and its work in immigration absorption and housing and education. I think that the influx of Jews, Soviet Jews, and Jews from Ethiopia and from around the world, actually, who have made Aliyah to Israel, come to Israel, the way they have handled them has been remarkable. I'm not going to deny they've had some problems with jobs and housing and so forth, but overall they've done a remarkable job. And I think they'd be really highly praised for what they have done. Of course, you know, we're unhappy about the slums in Israel. There are some in every country, and there's some crime, of course. As you know, we in Pittsburgh teamed up with Tirat HaKarmel. That's our sister city south of Haifa. And Sylvia and I are very much involved in that. And that's been a very gratifying thing to see that town turn around. Now people have pride there, and the town looks much nicer. It's very gratifying.
Now, as we've said, you've belonged to many organizations and have been an officer in many. Could you tell us what were some of the difficulties in any of these organizations, and how did you resolve them, or how were they resolved?
I'm not sure I resolved anything. But, most of them were like housekeeping things, nothing I would say that was philosophically very demanding. It had to do with maybe raising money or allocating money, things of that nature, or planning. I was involved in the beginnings of the National Association of Jewish Family Agencies, called the Association of Jewish Family Children's Agencies. And in the early days, we had to get membership and had to go with national funding bodies, if we get support, that sort of thing over the years.
If you could change anything in the Pittsburgh organizations, what would it be? The Pittsburgh organizations that you have been involved with.
I like to say nationally, I think we could do some things. I think we could really consolidate. I think there's a lot of duplication in Jewish Commonwealth Service. I think that that's an opinion shared by many people. Locally, I guess I would like to see more cooperation among the various components of the Jewish community. I think we have good cooperation now, but it could be somewhat better. At times there's been hostility. One of the problems I faced when I was president of the Federation, for example, was the adversarial position at that time between the Jewish home and the Federation. Now that's been resolved. And now, of course, it's in the Federation family, and I think it's going to be good. There's a study now about how to care for our elderly, and I think that's going to be good. So that I guess that I would have to say as a general statement that better cooperation among various agencies would be a goal. I think that I was sort of unhappy about the Monifer situation, but I guess that was inevitable. I think what happened in Montefiore was that the direction of the board in the early years, I'm talking about 1969, when they wanted to become what they called then Advanced Teaching Hospital, they made the overtures to the university, and I think they brought in some full-time people, and that became difficult for the staff, and there was a lawsuit. That was a very ugly period in our community as far as I'm concerned. I think really, more or less directly, that led to what happened later with Montefiore. Although I recognize that Jewish hospitals throughout the country have had difficulty, many have closed, but I think it would have been nice if we could have kept ours open. They have some that stayed open, like in Boston, for example.
While we're talking about the Pittsburgh Jewish community, how do you view the future of Pittsburgh Jewish community?
Well, I'm the perennial optimist. I think it's going to be fine. I'm worried, of course, about assimilation. I'm not sure what we can do about it. I think the outreach programs, the reform movements, are very good. But we live in an open society. In an open society, there are risks, and I think we're seeing the effect of it. Our children go off to schools outside the city. They meet Gentiles and fall in love and get married. And of course, I'm not smart enough to know why we have such a high divorce rate, but we do have social problems. But overall, I'm optimistic. I really think that somehow things will work for the better for us.
Correct. In your view, could you compare the past and the future of medicine?
Well, I think the future of medicine is certainly going to be more technological. I don't know about the cost of medicine. That's a big problem, naturally. We don't know what our president's going to do with his health panel. But it's certainly going to be different than it was. There's no question about that.
It's going to be better.
Well, I'm not sure it's going to be better. It may be better technologically, but as far as relationship between physicians and patients, I'm not sure it's going to be better. Because the way it is now, we're having what they call managed care, which means that in many cases, physicians don't make decisions, but managers do. And from companies, and their bottom line is to make money, regardless of what anybody says, that's the truth. And now the government is talking about managed competition. How that's going to work, I don't know. That means that consumers will get together and form alliances, and they'll negotiate with managed care providers and decide where they get the cheapest care. So I don't know how it's going to work out, to tell you the truth. Well, I realize the cost of medical care is so high that something has to be done. I just hope we do the right thing.
Will there be a closer relationship between doctor and patient?
Not at all, because the problem is that many times patients don't have a choice, and they came in with a chip on their shoulder to start with. They're seeing a doctor. They really don't want to see this doctor, but they have to see him because their insurance will pay, and that leads to problems. You talk about medical malpractice. I think that's a large cause of it in many cases, because there isn't that understanding between the physician and the patient, and the physician is an employee, and the patient is sent there because of the plan. And it's just not a healthy atmosphere many times.
Cindy, what was it like being a young Jewish doctor getting started as a surgeon? Did you experience any difficulties with the staff or the administration because you were Jewish?
Not I, no. I came in after that because I interned at Montefiore Hospital, which is a Jewish hospital. Although I did run into one problem. I wanted to take my residency in otolaryngology, and I was accepted at the Mayo Clinic where I wanted to go, which was one of the best residencies at the time, and I was told that if I didn't take it here at Pittsburgh, at the Eye and Ear Hospital, I would never get on the staff. I was just told that. So I gave up that residency, had a residency here. That was one troubling thing for me. But I didn't really feel prejudiced as such, I can honestly say.
Good, good, very good. I believe we have covered a great deal, but I still think there is much that you might care to comment on at this time.
Well, I
about your family. And
well, at this point, I'm not sure what I told you about my family.
Well, you believe. Do you believe that the mother staying home is important?
Yes. I do, yes. I realize in today's world with financial pressures and the need for two incomes, it isn't as easy. But I feel that my wife, Sylvia, did a wonderful job with our four sons. She trekked to the library with them all the time, read to them all the time. And they all turned out to be outstanding students, and I think a lot of it had to do with her care and concern when they were growing up and what she did with them, so I feel very strongly about that. As far as daycare is concerned, from the medical standpoint, a lot of kids just get sick there. I'm not sure about the abuse and all that business, which I guess is a concern. But I really think that raising a family is an important job, and I think that, I guess you could say man or wife could raise the kids, but in our day, she's the woman and the man made the living, so I don't know.
On behalf of National Council of Jewish Women, we thank you for your time, your patience, and your wonderful effort and experience that we have recorded.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your taking the time to do this, too, because this is a labor of love for you as a volunteer. So I thank both of you.